Are live.
Here we go.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It is Friday. Thanks for joining us today, and especially thrilled to have Mike Wolber from our partner list on today, talking about getting Hell Yes. I think it's especially exciting. I got a chance to reach out to connect with you and your team at AIM, and you guys just killed it at AIM. So appreciate for, I mean, especially being so forward and like sharing in terms of information and insights that you guys had. I had a chance to chat with Kristen Miller after the show and Chris
Salviati
afterwards, just trying to rip off slides like from the content. I mean, you guys must love it when you're presenting and people, all their cameras are up taking images and images and images. It was awesome. So like everything that's listening today, as always, getting Hell Yes, these are live shows and your comments are always fun and appreciated. I like to call it Stump the Chumps and see if you can get some stuff out there that throw us for a loop. We appreciate that. It keeps the show interesting and certainly engaged. The conversation we have on this show is about getting to Hell Yes. And the big premise that we talk about all the time is how the buyer's journey has changed from maybe previous years where we were out there looking to persuade people and get them to kind of buy our wares. Where now it's all about problem solving. And the challenge with that is trying to find the people that are out there that are seeking to solve those problems. And how are they signaling? What's going on in their life? What's the commonalities? Because we've got to do two things at the same time. Maybe we'll solve their problems, but we'll be able to find them and communicate them. So we are actively serving versus just like pushing and selling. And so that's something we're always trying to talk about in the show and always kind of following a narrative to discover further and further and further around how we can do that. As always, this is brought to you by IRCX. We are AI remote maintenance software for the property management industry. We'll help you solve triage and solve trips. So that's something looking to do right now. We'd love to connect. You can always reach out to me on LinkedIn. And for no further ado, Mike Wolber from Apartment List, Chief Sales Officer, and nutrition advocate for non-wrapped packaged goods. That was a funny LinkedIn thread.
Yeah, that one kind of popped, didn't it?
The other day. Mike, tell us a little about your background. How did you end up in this role? Should also mention you were a podcast host with Modern Multifamily, which is how I originally found you. And a bit about your background, your role. How'd you get in this role? What's a problem you guys solve at Apartment List?
Yeah, really excited to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. For everyone listening, how do you pronounce your name?
Guillermo.
Guillermo. Okay,
so Guillermo. G, the uniform for a long, long, long time.
I like it. So I've been in the prop tech space for coming up on 11 years. Started my career out, like really cut my teeth at Nike, which is cool because I've got this big brand on my resume. I was there for 6 years, met my wife there, really changed the trajectory of my career because I got to, you know, start as a young gun out of college, working in product creation, but ultimately, like a lot of people in big, big companies, I felt like a number, I felt like a cog in the wheel. My wife and I chose happiness. We moved to Bend, Oregon, really wanted to start our life together. We got married here in 2014. And at the time, there weren't that many technology opportunities here. And I wanted to be in tech. Found a company called G5, and it really changed my life because I found multifamily and I found high growth technology. And after 6 years, a great run up, the business was sold to RealPage. And so I left, moved my family to Utah, spent 4 beautiful years building an incredible business called Rent Dynamics with a couple of just dynamite founders that I'm still dearly close with. We sold that to Entrada in FY23. And once I finished like the people integration of the sales org, which I was leading, we moved back to Bend. And so this is where like the Apartment List story begins. Came back to Bend. My whole left arm is a sleeve tattoo of Bend, Oregon. It means a lot to me. And really wanted to find a business that had 3 distinctly like clear attributes. One is I wanted a business that was operated really, really well. Great operators, my peer group, the board, it needed to be badass. The second is that I wanted a team of people that I felt like I could just go to battle with because the people of a team are such a core DNA driver of success. And the third is I really wanted to be back in the marketing arena. And I found all 3 of those things at Apartment List. So been here for 13 months. The problem that we're solving is that we're helping customers turn marketing into move-ins at a very cost-effective and creative way. We're a marketplace. We're not an ILS. Cool business. We're growing fast. We're also growing responsibly. And like you mentioned at AIM, it's also a great brand. And working for a company that's got a great brand when you are a sales guy is a pretty dynamite opportunity. So I don't plan to go anywhere for a very long time.
I mean, it's certainly the when you get a chance to speak in front of a crowd like that and share insights that are uniquely derived from your own research, it's really powerful and compelling. Like it's very, particularly, when you go and talk about like holistic value for everybody in the audience and not to your product, like I always find it so much more valuable when it's not pointing to the problem that you're trying to solve specifically, but it draws attention to your brand as a thought leader in the space and a researcher and seeking to solve the problems that people are actively, almost like sourcing the problems people are actively seeking to solve.
Yep.
And I thought that you guys just did a great job. I chatted with Kristen Miller afterwards and had a chance to just quick chat with Chris. I thought it was awesome what you guys did. So well done there. I'm sure you guys had some good pulling. Plus you guys had a great tent and you nailed it. It was, for marketers in marketing, the bar to raise at a marketing conference for marketers is
for sure.
Pretty good. So then you talk about the problem so I appreciate you distinguishing a marketplace versus an ILS, because I actually had you guys as an ILS or in that category. So how do you differentiate between or distinguish the difference between a marketplace and an ILS?
Yeah, ILS, for those listening that aren't maybe clear what that stands for, internet listing service. When you think of an ILS, you think of a company where you're going, you're listing your property for rent. And no matter what is happening at your property, when you're performing, vacancy is high, vacancy is low, you're paying like a flat rate subscription to be listed on that website. We think of ourselves as a two-sided marketplace at Apartment Lace, or two-sided marketplace. So think of us like an Airbnb or an Uber for apartments, where it's our job to have a balanced marketplace. We need demand, which means we need renters coming to our platform, and we need the right supply, which is properties and units, to make sure that we can make a match. That's when we make magic in the move. And what makes us a little bit unique is that we're actually not invoicing partners until we've created a lease. And so it's the balance of our marketplace that makes us much more complex. And so I think there's just some subtle nuance there, which aligns us more to performance advertising, because you're typically not paying for Apartment List unless you're needing lease volume, which makes us harder to budget for, but much more easy to pay that invoice for.
So is it the case that, like in a conventional ILS approach, it's kind of more of a bulletin board where it is going to be a listing of service of available supply, and then just a bunch of ads driving people to that bulletin board, whereas you guys have a database of those that are seeking something and those that have something to create that match?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of super smart things that the ILS companies out there are doing to have premium listings and to make sure they drive traffic. I think what's really most different is the experience. If you were to go to another ILS, you're going to see all of the availability right there in front of you. You're going to see a map with a bunch of properties. When you come to Apartment List, we don't show you that. We have to get to know you first. We call it spend 5 minutes with us now to save 50 hours throughout your searching process. Yeah. So, we get to know you. What are you looking for? What's your ideal walk score? What's your desired price? What amenities are most important to you? And then we start to make matches. So you can swipe left, swipe right, and find the match. So a little bit more renter-centric and getting to know the renter first, so that we can then help that renter and ultimately our partners make magic when it comes to renting.
And so I find marketplaces terrifying, like to initiate and start, given that you've got to find the balance of both the supply and the demand side of things in order to make it, to create that, to broker that transaction. How did you guys start? Like, did you start regionally, or did you start, like, how did you get that nexus of supply and demand so you could actually create that connection?
Yeah, like a lot of companies, I think lots, like the founder story, John Cobbs is our founder. He's now our non-exec chairman. Lots of upfront, like starts and stops. And initially, we were actually more of a subscription service. And when we shifted to more of a marketplace model, making sure we had balance in the market, it's very much been an opening up market by market opportunity for us over the last 8 to 10 years. Now we're national, you know, we've got close to 45 sellers across the country. We work well in all markets. Not all markets are created equal for us, to be really clear and honest. But very much a market-driven kind of bottoms-up growth model for the, through those early years.
When so then your buyer, so while you create value for the renter, are they paying?
Nope. We work directly through property management companies and owner-operators to list their specific property. So our customer is kind of twofold. On the renter side of our business, we have an entire team that's getting to know renters, driving traffic and demand for them. But my team, I'm responsible for our go-to-market motion. We sell directly to the PMC or the owner-operator, typically into the marketing umbrella. So typically that regional or above is who we are interacting with.
Did you find like, so like one thing that we're discovering in kind of in our journey is that the owner manager influence on kind of like on ability to buy or desire, I'll say desire to buy versus the desire to the ability to buy or maybe even ability to implement can be really unique depending on the organization, like door to door almost. But now here's the but. I'm curious to get your opinion from a leasing perspective, given that there is like a harder line of motivation between like the manager and the owner. Is it cleaner? Cause like we're finding on the operations side, it's not so clean, but on the, I'm curious about the lease. It seems to me that it would be cleaner where the motivations are aligned.
They're aligned. I think one of the things that's like super nuanced is, you know, making sure that when you're interacting with a manager versus an owner, you know, an owner hires a property management company to run the operations for a property. And I think there's a lot of sales teams out there that really try to like sell to the owner to get the owner to force the management company to work with said provider. And it's a great way to burn a bridge that's really hard to repair because that management company, it's their job to make those operating decisions. And so what I've, you know, found is the closer you get to back office operations, like really all the work that happens after the lease, it's really important that both owner and manager are like lockstep. When you're making marketing decisions, it's really fast paced, you know, vacancy, leasing exposure, management companies and owners tend to be pretty high trust. Owners don't stay as involved in the actual marketing. There's some nuanced, you know, examples where owners are involved in decision-making. We have plenty out there, but for the most part, we really see the management company being the company we need to stay aligned with to make sure that we're doing work that aligns with them, their budget, their marketing distinctions, things like that.
Mm-hmm. When I've noticed that like when you get into the market of the conversations, and we've actually recently made this adjustment as well, is like, we are actually, when we target managers, we're clear that we're framing language around your owners, your clients, NOI, your, you know, like really serving the language that they have that aligns with their goals and objectives versus just having a straight, even if I just say just straight NOI, like they're not mobilized around NOI because that's not their organizational objective. Yep. But if I even insert the word of your client's NOI, then I can get their attention faster. And it's just simple framing like that of understanding that the different objectives of the different roles in the kind of like marketplace in the market and how we can begin to like just touch in what they're trying to find and what they're trying to achieve. So curious, like, what are you seeing? You know, at AIM, there was a ton of conversation around renewals. I thought it was measurable. Mm-hmm. So then how are you finding and given that you guys are in the lease acquisition side of things, how are you finding that conversation like shifting a little bit, or are you finding that conversation shifting a little bit when you're in the market talking about, hey, we can help you with the leasing, we can help you with acquisition, and then do they disclose to you, hey, like we're kind of like we're locked in on acquisition, but retention is really killing us. Do you have any ideas? Because you're trusted advisors to these people.
Yeah, we're spending a lot of time with our partners on the renewal, more resident engagement side right now. We're taking our AI product down towards renewals to help customers. Mm-hmm. Get ahead of that so we can start engaging with renters 60, even 90 days before their lease expires to understand their aptitude to want to renew. A, if they are, great, let's get ahead of that. And B, if they're not, man, that gives us way more time to go start smart marketing to go refill that building. So you have less days of that unit being vacant, which is super painful for the owner and the property manager. You know, and I think, you know, we're seeing supply and demand start to change balance, which means that you're seeing concessions really drive up. I mean, some of these markets we're seeing as much as 3 months of free rent to move in, especially with lease ups, and the cost of renewing is quite a bit less than the cost of finding someone new, depending on the market. So yeah, we're definitely seeing more requests for data, more requests for just overarching intel on how can you help on the renewal side. So it's good for us to be able to play offense here, but that conversation at AIM is definitely coming through in our day-to-day for sure.
Is there an opportunity for you guys to begin to channel, like if someone's looking, see, I mean, given that in this business, people don't churn out because of like 100% because they're upset at the way things are going. There's life changes, there's relocations, all sorts of stuff. Is there an opportunity for you guys, or do you do this already, to, if someone is seeking to not renew, but keep them within the same, I'll say, revenue organization?
Yeah, so you think about cross-selling, you know?
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
You look at a company like Funnel, right? Funnel's like really changed the way that the industry talks about centralized leasing or centralized operations. You know, if there's an opportunity to keep a renter within a branded ecosystem of UDR or Cortland or any of these big national companies, absolutely. We're looking at that today using cross-selling. We're looking at how can we align with our AI products as well as with strategic partners' products to make sure that, you know, if there's an opportunity of at least keeping them within the ecosystem, 100%. That's something that's important for our customers. And then for our, you know, property management partners, we typically try to align that around groups of owners. So we're actually doing it within their same owners. So they actually have more benefit to doing the right thing for their respective owners when they have dozens of different ownership groups they support, especially on the enterprise side of our business.
So when you're looking at like the different kinds of buyers, like who's seeking, like what, you know, let's go with the kind of the question around like, what are they typing into Google and they hit apartment list? Like, what are they seeking to solve?
I think for
how do they articulate what they're seeking to solve?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One, like the simplest one is, hey, we need help with demand. We don't have enough demand. We don't, our pipeline is too thin. We're looking for help in marketing. So apartment marketing is definitely like a big driver for attention. We need top of funnel.
Yeah.
We can help there. We've got a big, beautiful brand. We've got tens of millions of renters that we're talking to. So we help a lot there. I think the other thing is that, hey, we're looking for a smarter, potentially a more affordable way to market our properties. We don't want to pay a flat rate subscription anymore. Mm-hmm. We want more dynamic advertising. We want to spend when we need the performance. We want to cut back when we don't need the performance. And so dynamic advertising is an area that we win. Mm-hmm. Third, newer for us is now, hey, we want beyond just advertising. We want support in leasing intelligence and AI in more of this generative AI stuff. And so we've really made big advancements there. So now helping our customers use AI for leasing across chat, text, email, and voice has been a big part of our engagement and one that we're really accelerating throughout 2025.
Like, I found it really interesting now, especially with the conversations that you just have in the circuit and even like prospecting calls, is that it feels as though like the market was almost too hot for a long time. And now, like you just mentioned, kind of think about it, is that now they're actively seeking, like if you had a building and you had doors and a sandwich board, you could probably lease out, right? But now you need help. You need to figure out how to differentiate. You need to do all those things. And so are you finding, because you know, that finally we're not fine. Well, I shouldn't say finally out loud, but you know, we're in an era of crisis, and why not, let's not waste that crisis on doing things the old way. Are you finding people are coming at you now that didn't necessarily like have a problem to solve 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, great question. I think right now the big thing that we're seeing is that it's harder to operate right now than it has been in years past. And as a byproduct, our customers, the market in general, they're sweating the details. They are inspecting everything. 3 or 4 years ago, sure, we'll try this prop tech. Sure, we'll try this vendor. Sure, let's add this thing. We're not too worried because there's great demand. There's double-digit rent growth, like times are good. Mm-hmm. You know, as the tides are changing, I think there's just overwhelmingly more intensity right now, more inspection. Owners are getting more involved. They're running reports on their own out of the PMS to see what's performing, and they're getting involved for either adding or canceling. So yeah, I mean, we're having to play offense and defense in a much different way as operators to make sure that we stay in the conversation, and that we stay aligned to the things that matter most. Because one of the things that we're seeing across the board is that the table is getting bigger. There are more people right now at the decision-making table based on the intensity of operating right now.
I think it's really exciting.
It's awesome. We're playing offense. The great companies will win.
And I find that the questions are so much more tactical than they were even a year ago. Like, you feel as though people are jumping to filter out on the time-wasting conversations because they don't have a lot of time. They got a lot of problems to solve. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, good on this industry for adapting so quickly, because they, you know, when times were good, you know, like in any market, when times are good, you don't innovate. Why would you? Right. But like, now that we're getting nudged in an air and out of our equilibrium, there is an appetite to seek for change. Mm-hmm. And that's creating a whole different type of buying experience. Cause like we had to kind of like elevate why the problem that we saw was important, but now we're able to have conversations about like, hey, are we a good fit?
Yep, for sure. And I think qualifying, discovery, discernment, like you think about the attributes of a sales team, so much more discipline is required right now to make sure that, you know, you're being a good steward of your company's resources, that you're actually creating value for your customers. We typically call our customers our partners. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think right now it's like black belt operating, and I'm really enjoying it. Like, it's harder, but like the reward is so much greater right now. So this is far and away like my favorite chapter of operating that I've had in the last 15 years. It's also a hell of a lot harder than it's ever been in the last 15 years.
Yeah. I had a similar conversation today. You know, it was a conversation just about like whatever. And I was like, well, no, it's not that I hate it. It's just really hard sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I don't hate hard. I love hard. I just, sometimes I don't express myself fairly to the people around me.
For sure.
So when you take a look at the buyers in the market, like, how do you begin to filter on who's a hell yes? Like, who's going to move fastest?
You know, this is a good question. I was thinking through, I mean, I'll give you like the medium answer that I'm seeing, and like, please jump in. What worked really well the past couple of years is not working in 2025. Bottoms up selling was working really great for the last 3 or 4 years, defined as getting as close to the property as possible and then working your way up the food chain. Regional managers, associate community directors, depending on what you sell, if it's software versus marketing, bottoms up selling was working. Mm-hmm. Now what we're seeing is that no matter what, there is so much more oversight, there's so much more procurement, there's so much more intensity around operating expense, OPEX, and budget, that if you're not top down and bottom up selling, it's really hard to win right now. And so we're spending much more time, you know, what I tell our team about multi-threading, making sure that we have multiple people on our end, engaging with multiple people on the customer's end to make sure that we're really creating strength and alignment. So that's what we're doing. We're really seeing that, you know, if it wasn't a C-suite a year ago, it is now that ultimately is driving the decision. And we'd rather get ahead of that versus waiting to get all the way to contract to have a deal stall out. So we're really slowing down our sales process, getting a lot more methodical, a lot more surgical, and we're doing a lot more inspection in our business to make sure that the pipeline and the potential out there is really being worked with strategy.
You know, there's a really good example that I just kind of went through previously. Maybe you can play on this. Previously, if I went to an account, and let's say there's an account, you know, like in these accounts, there's like hundreds of buyers, right? Mm-hmm. And I was at a certain level, let's call it just a regional level or a senior regional level, and I'd get some meetings there. And then, you know, then all of a sudden you've got an EVP meeting, right? I would follow those plays independent of one another for fear that one would slow the other one down, right? Mm-hmm. So trying to treat them as independent sales opportunities, even if they're in the same kind of like same silo, because I just didn't want them to slow each other down. Now I'm finding that meeting a lot and said, hey, Mike, I'm talking to Chris as well, just so you know. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, I don't know how you guys buy on your side, but just so you know, I am talking to Chris and I am talking to Mike at the same time. And just as long as you're aware of that, and I'm probably going to treat them independently unless you tell me to bring them together. And I'm finding that the buyers are so much more like they know how to buy now more than before. And they're saying, oh, that's great. They'll either say, okay, tell you what, you talk to Chris and just let me know how that conversation goes so I know how to respond, or treat them as separate, or I'll take it and I'll let Chris know that we're going to run this on our side. And I find that just that transparency of how these deals are running, it's so much easier. As before, it was kind of like buckshot. And you just try and like get into how you could get in, and either one could buy. But now that because there's so much scrutiny on buying, then I'm really revealing that I want to partner early. Did you have experience in the previous where you're kind of like any way in is possible? And like, how did you manage that before?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's funny. I almost disagree with like some of what you said, and that like I'm still seeing that we're having to teach customers how to buy. So really? I think in general, there's this like responsibility as a salesperson, definitely as a sales leader, that you have to really make sure that the customer actually understands all of the series of sequences between now and getting to hell yeah, which is to me is to getting the contract signed.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that because budgets were managed a little bit looser the past, let's call it 3 to 6 years, with a small blip of it being tight during the early stages of the pandemic, it used to be loosey goosey. You could still get to a yes without the discipline of them knowing how to buy. Mm-hmm. Right now, hey, we know we only do proof of concepts to start, typically two struggling communities, two high performing communities. After 90 days, we come back, we make an evaluated decision. Mm-hmm. Do we have procurement? Do we not? Like a lot of these things are things that our customers don't know because they bought small expansion contracts, but not like full portfolio partnerships. So we really feel like there's a responsibility to make sure that we teach the customer how to buy versus assuming that they know how to buy, especially in the realm of AI, because AI is so new. And that's a big thing that we're focused on. So, hey, do you already have a buying committee assembled? Oh, no, what's that? Hey, typically we'd recommend someone from IT, your marketing office, and someone that's closer to property operations. Let's get a call with those three parties and then talk through what a go-forward plan would look like. So we try to plant a lot of bombs early so that we can teach the customer, but also manufacture great outcomes.
You know, it's funny. I had an experience once where we tried to do that with a deal. Say, hey, like, should we be talking to cyber and infra and IT? And the buyer was like, no, I'll take care of that. Like pull on the Heisman. And then one meeting, two meeting, three meeting, four meeting, five meetings, six meetings, couple 6 a.m. meetings, seven, you know, like, and then all of a sudden we get to the altar and the full deal falls apart. Because like, you know, when you got that single buyer on a deal, especially now, it's not a deal.
So talk about this every week with my team. We run a forecast call every Friday at 8:30 in the morning. Are we selling to this customer or are we talking to this customer about product? Those are really stark.
So how do you feel for that?
And you know, when I look at, are we selling, like, well, what are we solving for? Mm-hmm. Do we actually have something we're aligned to that's important for them that we can solve? Like that's how you solve that.
Yeah.
You know, I think the second thing is more complex companies. You know, I think an upfront qualification framework is great. I've deployed Medic. I've deployed MedPick.
Yeah.
Those are great. We don't have one of those in place today at Apartment List. But, you know, ultimately, I think it's the ability for you to sit down with your managers, which is what I do, or if you're a frontline leader, with your reps to understand what metrics are we aligned to? Who actually signs the contract? Who's the decision maker? What's the timing? Like these baseline questions. Because I think what I've seen a lot is that teams have happy years. And as a byproduct, they spend all the time talking to people that have no interest or intent of actually buying. And I want my team talking to people that have an intent of buying. We'll help them buy. Mm-hmm. But if they have no intent of buying, they can watch a YouTube video about our product. We don't need to be talking to them.
You know, it's funny. So something we started doing this year, January-ish, is that, so we use Spiced instead of MedPick.
Yep.
Which is, I mean, it's really whatever you want to use. And I've started including, so we take the transcripts, run it through chat GPT, like a GPT we have built of all of our calls, and prepare the email follow-up in there. And we actually play out the whole spiced framework and send that back in the reply to the customer.
It's cool.
Right. Cause then, cause they're like, you know, they don't acknowledge, like if it says like, it'll say, hey, buying committee is not, you know, buying committee is not, the champion might be so-and-so, it might be Mike. And it'll actually infer that. And I'll just say, hey, here's my three bullet summary of the meeting. Here's our actions and next steps. And then below is our, just our sales, our evaluation of the first call and some of the gaps we might have. And like, I've gotten so many compliments back. Like, I've never looked at this way before. I'm like, that's how we, cause we used to hide that behind veiled glass of like what we want to, what we need to get out of the next call. Cause I really want to bring them along. And if they don't know what the buyer's journey looks like, I want them to see, here are the gaps. Here's the impact that I heard, the happy years thing, right? Like impact part of happy in MedPick, in Bant, in Spiced, like it is what you want to hear sometimes.
Always. Yeah.
Right? And then if you put it out there that here's the impact, 1, 2, 3, and they go look at it, and then they, and then you go validate that for the next call, they'll be like, that's not the impact. This is the impact. Or those aren't really, and then you kind of, in the next meeting, you go, hey, these are the three impacts. Are those still priorities?
And yeah, like, well, there's this really great follow on LinkedIn. Her name is Jen Allen Knuth. And she talks a lot about COI, like cost of an action. And that's like something I use now, which is like, if you can tell me what the cost of an action is about a deal, that means we're selling, because we've anchored to pain and something they're really trying to solve for. We can help them get there. If we can't articulate a COI or a cost of an action, we're just talking to them right now. And until you can articulate that very simply, even if that means adding on cost when things are tight as heck right now, without being able to articulate a COI, brutal to be able to actually say, yeah, I'm selling to this account.
You know, it's funny. I had never heard of that expression before, and I thought I was pretty red in this space. And we was doing a live with Mason Mello, who sells for, I can't remember who he sells for, but anyways, he was, we met him at Happy Summit, and we got to talking. He talked about COI, and I was like, I've never heard that before. So I dug in on it and spun out like a whole calculator on how to calculate the COI, which then goes and frames your discovery questions.
Totally.
Right. And so you're just, so now it's interesting. And just had this conversation, just work this, work. I've got three bulls I got to get back today. And, but the, I had a discovery call yesterday, and in terms of the COI and available budget, now part of our questions is like, so we saw maintenance, well, how many open maintenance positions do you have? Right. Well, I've got 12. Okay. But I don't have any budget. And I said, well, if you've got open 12 positions, you've got budget, because every single month you're not staffing those positions. And so then they were like, oh yeah, I guess I do have budget. Because just because it's been earmarked does not mean it's spent.
Totally.
So let's make sure we're closing the door, we're closing the gap on average age of open work orders, and you know, time to respond, and trips and cost. Because you're not going to do it by not spending that money.
Exactly. And I think a lot of times, you know, we just went through a really long buying. Actually, no, it's an efficient buying engagement with Gong. You know, I think a lot about like helping customers find budget. That's a great like example that I think a lot of folks don't think about. You know, most companies think about their budget in like two really distinct separate line items. Like one is like your software, your tech operating expense. And then one is your payroll and personnel operating expense. They don't think about those as being connected. But if we're over in software, but we're 3 months behind on hiring, you can very much work with a champion to go work with their finance team to find budget there. Yeah. You have to be having those conversations. And I think without that level of specificity, again, I think a lot of selling teams spend too much of their time talking about product, not actually selling.
Well, and what's interesting is that when you get into the conversation, one of our questions we always ask is like, what are the alternatives to solving the problem, right? So an alternative apartment list might be hire 10 listed leasing agents that are going to go knock on doors. Like, we talked about one yesterday where the it was for sensor software, where an alternative to solving the problem with sensor software was go and have a maintenance tech inspect every apartment every month. That is a way of solving the problem. So it kind of backs up to that Clayton Christensen, you know, jobs be done theory, is that this is the job to be done. I'm hiring a person, I'm outsourcing it to a vendor, or I am buying software or buying software. Those are kind of like the top three ways of solving a job.
Yep.
And when you back that up, how you mentioned it, is that those are the budget categories you can pull from in order to solve the job. But if I'm just selling you software, then I'm committing to just that line item in the software budget, which, exactly, by the way, you didn't think about my software when you made that line item.
Yep. Yeah, just too one-dimensional. And that's where I think, like, you know, I think a lot of sales leaders still like measure win rate, or they still measure like sales cycle time. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really happy to see my win rate, you know, go down. I'm really happy to see my sales cycles get longer, as long as there's like intention behind those things. And one of the things I'm always happy with is seeing my sales cycle get longer, so my average deal size goes up. When I can slow down, bring in a few more decision makers, and rather than starting with three properties, let's start with 70% of the portfolio by spending two extra weeks stepping through decision making. So there's clear line of sight to what this portfolio partnership actually looks like. And so I think everything you're talking about is exactly what people need to be thinking about in sales.
What's interesting, though, the way you described it, is that we can't take that approach to portfolio, because I've got to acknowledge that there has to be a proof point for me to earn the right to that 70%. Mm-hmm. And so, like, we have to, and I think that for everyone to listen here, like, the strategies are relevant to the company that you're in and the stage of what that company's at.
Big time.
You guys have been around since like 2011 or 13 or something like that. Like, you are a known commodity. We're still offering a new way of solving an old problem. And so we need to have the reverse of that. We need to have shorter deal cycles and go to a pilot and like use that bowling pin framework where we have to knock down that. We have to take all of our energy and focus on that single pin, because that single pin will knock down the second row, the third row, the fourth row, the fifth row, because, you know, the strike is not available to us, or I can't design for that. I have to design for a pilot framework, proof of concepts, case studies, and use a case study method to grow our pipe, because there's too much risk. Well, I have to design for a buyer that acknowledges that there's risk in buying from somebody who isn't, an established way of doing things.
Yeah. I mean, I think with brand and like some of those things comes like an ability to push differently. But I also would say that for like an operator, I really think there's a clear difference between product market fit and go to market fit. And it sounds to me like you've got product market fit and you're really in this motion of trying to like get tight on what your go to market fit looks like. Cause my guess would be that you and your team, if you got enough reps against that, you could probably tell customers, hey, we always start with the pilot. Once you see these 12 things happen, that's when it's time to expand to a portfolio. We're actually going to say we're going to sign the full portfolio on now and start with the phased rollout based on the things we know, which is all go-to-market fit, to me at least, as an operator.
Oh, that makes a good point, because then that actually would influence our pricing.
Yep.
Right? So our pricing can scale up, because it's interesting. So we just recently went from we only start with pilots to now – annual contract with 90-day exit, which is kind of like the baby step past the pilot, because now the contract is already negotiated and agreed to prior to, you know, to go date. And then we have that lined up. So then we can kind of make sure our pricing can scale up as they begin to increase consumption.
Yeah,
so that's, for sure. I didn't even like acknowledge that that's kind of what we're doing, but that's what we're trying to solve for and are kind of like inching towards that go-to-market fit.
Yep,
still working our way towards there.
Yeah, that's so cool.
When you talk about like one thing we like to talk a lot about is and this came up in the conversation with Joe Summers, is capturing versus creating urgency. So conventionally, it was always like, how do you create urgency? How do you identify that compelling event? And so this whole capturing urgency is something that we were just chatting about like literally 2 weeks ago. The idea being that people have their own timelines and our quarter doesn't mean shit to them. And so how do you go and filter for folks, for prospects that are seeking to commit to change?
Yeah, that's a cool delineation between capturing and creating. I mean, I think like the most elite sales teams can like completely manufacture urgency to a degree once they have a prospective or a current customer on the hook. But I think it's not possible without capturing something first. And like what I talk a lot about with our teams, I learned this from my first ever sales enablement mentor, shout out to a guy named Steve Crapo, is that all deals are won and lost in discovery and discernment. All deals. Defined super specifically as running discovery to understand what's most important to the customer. Strategic, tactical. I mean, you should be talking 20% of the time. They should be talking 80% of the time. That's what discovery is. But what discernment is it's using what you learned to then create, after you've captured via discovery, urgency to hold them accountable to. And I think that's where you have to get like a lead as a salesperson, is being so good at asking and listening that down the road, when the objection of budget or bandwidth or time or integration or price, the things we all know to be the core objections, you can go back to discovery and continue to discern to drive it forward. But if you never ran that great discovery, which should be a process, it's not a moment in time, you never win. You just never win.
What I find it interesting in terms of like the when you get ghosted or deals just go quiet, like the follow-up email of, hey, Mike, just following up, like that's just like one more email.
Exactly.
But I'm saying, hey, Mike, when we chatted the first time, you indicated that you're looking to solve this by then. And you can test fairly, is that still something you're looking to do? Is that still on your to-do list? Is that still a priority for you? And you might have forgotten that it was, or something else, or the house went on fire, like something happened. But then you get that test back of saying either they don't answer you at all, which happens, or they respond going, yeah, no, that is actually still a priority. But to your point, you can't be talking the whole time in that first call. And it's so hard as sales folks, if you don't have those methodologies in place, to just get up there and show up and throw up. And I think that it's really like it's a discipline to get it, that you need to have an objective that you're seeking to achieve, like a form and questions that you need to always fill out.
Yep.
And that's why the sales methodology is so important.
For sure. And I mean, where did that come from? It's like one of those things too that like I think it's the thing I like the most about like discovery or kind of this like early but ongoing part of sales is it's also a total skill. Like it's something that you can like develop, but without repetition and like practice against it, you know, the most common thing I see in salespeople is on the first call, within the first 5 minutes, they're sharing a deck and they're word barfing. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time they've ever talked to this company. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't share the slide unless I am being begged to show slides, even during a demo. I would much rather talk through it with you and do something I call, which is verbal volleyball. Like how many back and forths can I get within a call? That interaction score and gong, that question rate and gong are really good indicators of discovery strength for your team. But yeah, you're spot on. I mean, capturing versus creating is a good way to think about it. I think both can exist, but not without good capture of understanding. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this is where a lot of companies out there are spending time talking to companies that actually don't have an intent of buying, and that's okay, but call it what it is.
Yeah. Well, I think that what's helped with like the gongs, the fathoms, the fireflies, all the call recorders in the world, like they are really helping to clear out that smokescreen of happy ears, because as a sales leader, you don't even need to listen to the call anymore. You just pump the transcripts into a GPT and ask it for a Spiced or a MedPick or whatever. And I'll even take like, if we've had three or four calls, I'll take all those transcripts and put them into, because usually people start coming onto the sales deal as it progresses through the stages. I'll keep adding in to that GPT all the conversations we've had to date, just so everyone has a single perspective where we're at. Because if I don't bring up what Mike said in call one to Chris in call four, and then that's my anchor for the conversation, then, and Chris might disagree, that's not a priority.
Yep.
I'm going to try and anchor that back as a pull, as an urgency event. And Chris just flat out disagrees because Mike was off, you know, polishing his own shoes. Like then I'm going to lose the deal.
Absolutely.
You know, and I find it's interesting. There's no excuse anymore, because with call recording software and GPTs, like the ability to get better faster is very obvious. Like you ask it, rate this call. What could I have done better?
Yep.
How could I manage the objections? How could I have groomed those objections better?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a lot of times people define like coachability as like, are you willing to receive feedback? My definition of coachability is like really evolved, because as you're talking about this, like it's never been easier to get good as a salesperson, because the signal is everywhere these days. But I think what like my definition now of coachability isn't, are you willing to receive it? It's willing, are you willing to act on it? Seek it out and act on it. Because very easy to spend 5 minutes a day reviewing your transcripts, improving on one thing, and then trying it and measuring it after a week. But again, that's still only something that the one percenters are doing today.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. My oldest, he's a junior, and he's going to senior year, and he's looking for a job. And I, after talking, this whole last couple of years, like he's in accounting right now. And I was like, I really think you should take a sales job. And he's like, well, what would that be? And so I said, I think you should do door to door. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, he's on 100. So he's out there doing 100% commissions. And so he's done like 4 or 5 days. And I said, and he's telling me, I go, so what kind of advice are you getting? And he's like, well, they actually, so one thing is, how do I get them in the slot? He's selling permanent, like Christmas lights. Mm-hmm. You know what that is?
Oh yeah.
And so he's selling that door to door, and he's like, yeah, I'm trying to get them in the slot. I'm like, what's that mean? He goes, well, I need to get them to step outside the house. Because the second they step outside the house, now they're on his turf, right? And this is 4 days of doing this, or 5 days of doing this.
Cool.
And so like, but just learning the nuances of the you know, in that case, the body language, but the acceptance of the problem, and to learn that so early. I was just saying to him, I said, ultimately, I had this call with the CEO that we're having the show in a few weeks. Like the ability to sell internally is also something that needs to be groomed. Mm-hmm. And it's not just up to us externally to do that, especially as we're dealing with crisis right now, where, if you need to get your budget items moved forward, you've got to think about how you're selling as well.
100%. And I think that's like a really good example of like the slot. Like, I think so many salespeople have so many things they're thinking about or chasing in a sales engagement. They're like, the easiest thing you can do is have like one next step that's your goal, so you know what you're driving towards. Because I'd much rather have a rep have 4 really good deals in their pipe versus 30 fake deals in their pipe without that one thing to chase. But that's such a good example. Door to door, all the best reps I've hired have done like a solar run. They've done, I just bought Christmas lights. I just bought from your kid here in Oregon. Those skill sets are so good for you.
I really hope it, well, anyway, that's what we decided for him, but it is interesting to hear that come back at that conversation. I had him pitch us at the dinner table the other night, and he like did his pitch, and I was like, it's awesome. And then I kind of paused it, and I was like, did you hear that part when you said that? And I was like, we were role-playing. It was fantastic. Yeah. I just miss those days. So when you guys are out there and like the alternatives that are available, and not everybody says yes, like what objections do you typically hear?
I think, for me, I've really boiled down objections to be pretty consistent regardless of like the thing I've been selling. One is timing. There's always going to be a timing budget or objection. There's always going to be a budget objection. I think the objection that I'm most scared of typically is this like status quo objection. Yeah. And so I think for us though, it ends up being, hey, we're mid-year. We've already set our marketing budgets. It's like not a good time to like add something new. So then it becomes, well, how do we get creative on making the commercial component work? Mm-hmm. And I think the second one from that is usually something around like, hey, we've already got a couple other, vendors in motion in this space. And then that's where I think typically where you'll see us recommend going back to the go-to-market fit, like what a really focused pilot would look like, so we can help them measure us with specificity. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we can typically engineer something out of most objections. Mm-hmm. Status quo or correct decision maker are the two ones that I see most often, mm-hmm. Which are typically our fault in the process, which I like because it's an opportunity for us to like use that to move forward, even if it means slowing down that deal.
The status quo one is, I think it's everyone's, speed kills all deals. Status quo is the number one adversary thing you got to sell from behind. It was a really good, I was chatting with a guy named Rob Snyder, who's mentoring me on some stuff. And he talked about like equilibrium, right? Like humans that are in equilibrium are very resistant to exit equilibrium, mm-hmm. unless they're bumped. And the bump typically is an external force that bumps you out of equilibrium. If you're just fine, you know, like we were chatting with somebody else, like if you've got like 15,000 units and you're going to be at 15,000 units and you've got kind of things, you've got a little bit of turnover, but it's not that bad. And you're making enough money and you're making all your things, like that equilibrium is, it's hard to get you to change out of that. But if you're 15,000 units and you want to grow to 30,000 units, you've intentionally changed, or maybe you're acquired by a P&E firm or something else has happened. Like a refinance is coming up. Like all of a sudden those external events are bumping you out of equilibrium and forcing change. And then the status, but I find those people, they may not be aware their status quo changed. And it's the discovery, going back to your discovery point, that pulls out the reveal that, oh, well, yeah, you know what? We do have this coming, this happening. And I should be thinking about that. If I don't think about that, something negative is going to happen.
For sure. And I mean, I think about it like this really clear distinction of on the business versus in the business questions. Mm-hmm. And I think most reps ask a lot of in the business questions, minutia this week, this month, mm-hmm. this quarter. On the business questions is like, hey, are you on the board? Probably not. Like, what's the board talking about right now for your team? Mm-hmm. Hey, there aren't that many REITs in our space, obviously, but when they are, you can read an earnings call and understand exactly what their priorities are. Hey, we want to remove one headcount from every site by the end of FY26. Cool. Like I'm going to anchor to that. So
yeah.
I think there's this like on the business, like series of discovery that if you get comfortable asking questions about, hey, what does your boss care about? What are you held accountable to? Like going back again, cost of inaction. I think that's where you can typically get your way to some sort of an outcome when you can really understand the on the business side. But so many people are so comfortable in the minutia that they never actually take the conversation up there, because those are the ones where you really get the customer to say, and that's where things get pretty good.
Interestingly though, so do you find that I love that language, on the business, in the business, that like you can misfire if you take the wrong style of questioning for the wrong level of the organization.
For sure.
Like the on the business stuff is kind of like, they're so detached from me I'll say site level, offsite level. And just to kind of like make it simple to imagine, but like there's stuff that you can say about in the business. Like if I'm asking questions around open job postings, like that's kind of like a in the business stuff. But I'm talking about like average age of open work orders, it's going to be an on the business question. Yep. That the maintenance tech itself, they're not going to know, right? And so we try to have to figure out, to your point before, like around the bow tie method, we've got to bow tie it, because I've got to get the executive with the most amount of budget agrees to buy, they're still going to have to vet it and implement it through the site level. And so I need to get the site level, I need to do the trick of having the site level think it's their idea, and then, or agree that it's their idea, or, you know, vocalize that this is something that's going to solve their problem. Mm-hmm. And then have that budget come from the top that aligns with the larger objective that you just described. And that's something I'm getting better at, but it requires work.
Yeah. It should all be persona based, right? Mm-hmm. So like I think about a lot of salespeople that still sell to property teams. Mm-hmm. I don't think selling to a property team is the right move. Like I think when I go to talk to a property team, that's boots on the ground. I want to ask the property team, what's going on? What's the quality of your foot traffic? How's conversion been? How's your show rate been for tours? What are you hearing about why you're losing deals to competitors? Is it price? Is it walk score? Is it caliber of your amenities? Because what I get there, this is apartment list, is bottoms up intel to now go top down to go tell the CFO, the COO, this is what your properties are dealing with. Mm-hmm. They probably don't know that. Now there's this awesome opportunity to use what I just learned to then anchor to your on the business objectives to create more outcomes. So I just think that's where persona-based questions, if I ask a property manager too big of a question, I'm going to get kicked out. But if I go in with the right approach, I can actually use that to create a selling opportunity to someone more senior.
And that's a strategy. Mm-hmm. Like that's not a, you didn't fall on that. That's a strategy to go get some intel from the field so you can bring it to the top level as an actionable move.
Yep. I think that top down and bottoms up in unison approach is going to be one of the key ways that teams win or lose going forward, because followership and buy-in is so important. You know, it's one thing to buy tech, which is what people were doing the last 3 or 4 years, only to deploy it for the field team to get dusty or disappointed. They got to be coordinated. And we think that the leaders are good at coordinating, but they might not know how to do that. Again, do they know how to buy? So if you can bring people along and help create common connection, I think that's where, as an elite salesperson, there's a lot you can do to be, to turn a prospect, let alone a customer, into being a raving fan.
Mm-hmm. This is what makes it interesting about like sales, is that ultimately we're problem solving, and I mean, there's kind of derogatory terms around it. Like, you know, we're, you know, managing a play school or whatever, but like ultimately the good ones are problem solving, but the trick is to solve someone else's problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, and suspend your quarter, your ambitions and all this. And that's really hard to do.
Really hard, but really fun.
Yeah. 100%. So you take a look at yourself, you know, when you first started, maybe new people are coming into Apartment List, and you want to give them some advice, some direction on how they can execute and operate. What's a bit of advice you'd give them with respect to getting to LES?
Are you talking about a new hire here or a customer?
A new hire at Apartment List, or maybe even yourself when you were younger.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say like one of the single biggest attributes is thinking big. And
okay.
I think thinking big is like so dang important. And what I mean by thinking big is don't play for quota. Quota is your job. What does it look like to get to 200%?
I love it.
And then how do we zoom back from there? I think the bigger I've thought in my career, the more reps I've had come to me saying, hey, I want to 2X the cash that I made last year. This year, help me get there. They're all pacing, but only a few reps have come to me and thought that big.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think one of the biggest things I've learned in my career that I see here at A-List, it's a big, beautiful business with a big, beautiful trajectory in front of it, is coming in with gumption and with a high desire to win. My favorite operating principle at A-List is play to win. And the reps that really play to win, not to do their job, which is to hit their quota, but to win, they all win. And I'll see them all in President's Club next year.
I love it.
So that would be my thing.
I just finished a book. I signed myself up for a course called Strategic Coach. And the guy that runs it is Dan Sullivan. And he's got a book called Why 10X is Easier Than 2X.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is that if you're thinking in 2X, it's actually way harder than if you think in 10X. Because when you think in 10X, you eliminate distractions that are 2X enablers.
Even like a very specific example, and I know we're getting up against time, is that one of my favorite activities for a sales leader, and this cascades down to like the sales reps on our team, is what are the 5 dream deals
mm-hmm.
for your team? Let's talk about them once a week.
Mm-hmm. Don't everyone say good.
That's called manifesting. Like, like, guess what? 2 of those 5 have already closed this year. And it's that kind of stuff that I just think when you think big, you activate differently, you show up differently, you work differently. And I just think there's a lot to be said about like really encouraging a team to really play offense and to think bigger than they ever have before, but also as a leader to like show them that like you're willing to get into the trenches with them to help mm-hmm. them get to the outcome. But thinking big far and away is my biggest thing.
The difference that you just said is you didn't just say think big, you also said visualize big,
mm-hmm.
which is a different, that's a next degree over. Than
that's the and. That's like there's thinking and then there's like visualizing. But I mean, I think that kind of thing is just like all examples of like what it looks like to be elite and to be top 1% and to mm-hmm. be a career changing like salesperson is thinking big, but also doing the habits of success daily to get there. QBRs, open to inspection, being coachable, reaching out to me and asking for my time. All that kind of stuff starts with thinking big, but mm-hmm. then it comes in the things that follow.
Outstanding. I love it. I'm excited, especially since I'm starting this course next week. It's been outstanding chatting with you. I appreciate everything you've done. For those that even going back and listen to the podcast, your podcast, Modern Multifamily, even going back a couple of years, like some of the guests that you had on there, the hit list is impressive. And I think that I would say to some degree it inspired me to put this show together and just say, hey, let's just see what happens. So appreciate everything that you've done, everybody. And thank you, Monica. Appreciate it. Thanks, Monica. Thanks, Mike, for coming on the show and sharing, everybody. Who should we have on next?
So have you talked to a guy named Ben Stewart by chance? I went back and I don't think I saw. So Ben Stewart, co-founder at a company called Revise.
Okay.
He's also my next door neighbor here in Bend. We were boots on the ground, neck to neck, building G5 together for about 6 years. He's a business operator. He's a heck of a salesman. He's also a great husband and a great dad. He's my hell yeah. I learned a lot from Ben, but Ben Stewart would be a really great guest.
We'll get him on. That'd be outstanding. And get a hold of you, best way?
LinkedIn's easy for me, man. I'm visible. I'm easy to find. I'm active on the platform at least an hour and a half every single day. Mike Wolber, mwolber at apartmentlist.com, and huge advocate for this industry. So whether it's an opportunity to work together, to support, or even just to be a mentor, I'd love the opportunity to connect.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mike. And so for those that want to get a hold of me, I'm on LinkedIn as well. If you see this and it's not live, you can post comments. We'll see that there. If you're listening on the podcast, comment, subscribe. We'd love to hear things like there. We appreciate that. And thanks, everybody. Really appreciate everyone listening in. It's Friday. It's end of the week. Go close it out. And we're coming up on Apartmentalize in a few weeks. So
we'll see you there.
See you there.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. Right on, man. That was fantastic.